Hello and welcome to the SoundNose podcast. I'm Barry Collins. SoundNose takes billions of measurements of internet performance every day, and all that's made possible by a small but powerful piece of software called The Agent. The Agent is a software that powered SoundNose white boxes and is now more commonly found inside broadband routers. It's been developed over the course of 15 years, and in the first of this series of articles looking at the story of SoundNose, we're talking to the company's founder, Sam Crawford, about how the agent was first developed, how it's evolved over time, and how it delivers insights to SoundNose clients that no other company can. I started by asking Sam what the state of broadband testing was like when the company was first formed back in 2008.
That's going back away. So in 2008, broadband rollout in the UK, so I/we were very much UK-centric at that point. That's not the case anymore. But at that time, still very, very UK-centric. And the state of broadband in the UK, as it was available in, I think, more than 90 or heading towards 95% of homes. So rollout was almost was nearing ubiquitous at that point. Some interesting things were happening in the industry. So if I remember rightly, we were moving well towards ADSL 2+ at that point, towards 24 megabit broadband. And we started seeing operators, so ISPs, competing a lot more and lowering their prices. One of the operators, I think it was 2008, called TalkTalk, they launched a free broadband product, which basically meant you got a free broadband connection when you bought the phone line. And that was very revolutionary at the time. In fact, I don't think anyone does that anymore. But there wasn't really, certainly the advertising, I don't think, was particularly fantastic. I remember driving somewhere at some point and seeing a billboard on the side of the road, side of the motorway, advertising free broadband or very, very low cost broadband from some provider. And there was no caveats, even in the fine print, about the kind of speeds you should expect during peak hours or anything like this. And nowadays, that I don't think, I think you just kind of take it for granted. You're going to generally get pretty good speeds all the time if you're on a good ISP in a well-provisioned area and so on. Mm-hmm. But at that time, you definitely couldn't take that for granted. There was lots of capacity problems all the time. And in particular, this is going back to the days of when BitTorrent was a really big thing. Nowadays, we don't even think about BitTorrent anymore, I think. This is before the days of Netflix basically dominating, and others dominating, data transfer or bandwidth of all of these operators. So BitTorrent was still a very big thing. And traffic shaping was still a very, very big thing amongst the operators. So they'd all have these big DPI, deep packet inspection machines inside their network, which would look at the traffic passing through the network and rate limit them effectively. And that's because they ultimately didn't have enough capacity to handle everything. So I thought, wouldn't it be great if there was some way of shining a light on this, on the actual performance that users could expect to receive? Because there really was big differences between the providers themselves, simply due to their traffic shaping policies. But there was nothing out there. So I figured there was basically two things a little wrong with the industry or with what was out there so far. So number one, everything was very focused on speed alone. It was all about just running speed tests. Yeah. There wasn't really any consideration of latency or packet loss or even variation by time of day or looking at different protocols. No one was measuring anything like BitTorrent or web page loading times or anything else. And there were still problems with DNS response times from ISPs, DNS servers all over the place. So just running pure speed tests alone, I didn't think was enough. And secondly, if we were going to do something, whatever we did would probably show some or all of the operators in a bad light, at least on some metrics, right? Not everyone's going to be perfect on everything. Mm-hmm. So we wanted to make sure that whatever we did would be really, really defensible. And this was really the foundation for everything that came next. So going back to your question, it's not so much that the speed tests at that time were particularly flawed. The actual speed tests themselves were perfectly reasonable, I'm sure. But it was the fact that they were A, quite limited, i.e. it was only speed tests, and B, the methodology around, so the plumbing around the tests, I thought was the limiting factor from them being used for something more serious, which could draw criticism from some parts of the industry. With all of this, it really depends on the use case of what you're trying to do. Our use case was one where we wanted to be quite granular and quite specific and say, for example, you know, BitTorrent performance on BT retail at 8 p.m. in London was X, or latency on Virgin Media at 10 p.m. in Manchester was Y. So we wanted to be quite specific about that, literally naming operators and packages and regions and so on, and have it be fairly comparable amongst them, amongst all of them. Ultimately, with a view that this might, you know, we'd be publishing this, we want to stand behind it. We weren't thinking at that point about regulators or anyone using the data. At this point, I had never even spoken to Ofcom or any other regulator ever. My background is in computer science, so you want to make sure it's what you do is robust.
How did the methodology you devised differ from what other speed tests were doing at the time?
It wasn't so much the speed tests themselves. It was the all of the methodology and the plumbing around that. There was two kinds of camps of thought at the time. Actually, let's say three camps of thought. Very, very top level, there is passive measurements and there are active measurements. So in the passive measurement space, that is where you are analyzing traffic, which real users are generating, and you are inferring some performance characteristics from that traffic analysis. So this is the kind of thing that a deep packet inspection, a DPI box, will do. It will look across users and say, oh, Barry is using 3 megabits per second right now, and we can see that he's connecting to servers with Netflix in Netflix's IP range, so we'll say it's 3 megabits per second of Netflix traffic. Mm-hmm. And if you kind of squint a little bit and you do some TCP stream analysis, you can draw inference about latency, you can draw inference about bandwidth, and you can certainly obviously conclude how much users are consuming. There's real pros and cons to passive analysis. The pro is that you don't need to be inside users' homes to do this. You don't need the user to do anything. You can do all of this on centralized kit inside the ISP's network. So if you're an ISP, passive analysis you probably already have some passive analysis, some DPI kit in your network for things like law enforcement, data usage metering, perhaps. So this can initially appear quite appealing. Of course, from a measurement point of view, there's some big pros and cons. So pro, it can be easy to deploy for operators. It can scale fairly well, although, you know, at the kind of levels these guys are talking about, it really struggles. Yeah, I guess the other pro is that it doesn't require lots of interaction from users. Mm-hmm. The cons, though, are, well, one, you only get measurements when users are actually using their broadband connection. So if you're asleep between, say, 10 p.m. and 7 a.m. or something, then there's no DPI analysis is going to be performed on your usage. So there's going to be no statistics about how anything performs at that time. Two, obviously, it's like a privacy minefield, basically analyzing users' traffic. I'm sure the ISPs are able to do this. It'll be all covered in their T's and C's and so on. But certainly, we definitely don't want to be anywhere near that kind of stuff. It's just a minefield. And I guess the other con is there's going to be factors way outside of your control. So if you are, let's say you're downloading a very large file from the internet, then a DPI box might look at the TCP stream or the quick stream and infer the maximum throughput you receive during that stream and say, oh, this is Barry's download speed at this time. But of course, the end-to-end stream's performance is going to be impacted by both ends of the connection and everything in between, right? So you're not really just assessing the ISP there. You're including factors like your in-home Wi-Fi, whatever machine you're using, you know, laptop, phone, whatever, and also where you're downloading from. So if you're downloading onto your laptop at the end of your garden over a Wi-Fi link, over your ISP's network in the UK, from a server in China, then you're obviously going to get a terrible download, or you're most likely going to get a terrible download speed. And obviously, it would be completely unfair to attribute that performance to your ISP.
So what about active measurements, Sam?
Active is where something inside the home, either a bit of software or a bit of hardware, generates its own traffic and then measures some characteristic in response to that traffic. So, for example, you could imagine a piece of software installed on your computer, which would fetch Google.com. So it'd visit Google.com automatically by itself once an hour and time how long it took a page to load. That's an example of an active measurement. Active measurements can be deployed in basically one of two ways. You can either have crowdsourced measurements, or you can have dedicated probe-based measurements. So 2A is crowdsourced. So crowdsourced is very much along the lines of what you'd see from a very well-known speed test websites and applications, where a user might visit the website, click run test now, and they get the result back 10 seconds later, or they might install an app and press the run test now button, and they get the results. Maybe there's some scheduled element to it, but usually not. Usually it's just on-demand, user-driven measurements. Yeah. So there's pros and cons to this as well. You'll be unsurprised to hear. Mm-hmm. So pro, it's super accessible for the users. You know, it can be as simple as just visiting a site, pressing a button. Another pro is because of its accessibility, you get millions of users using these things. So you build up a really large data set, probably quite quickly. But there are cons as well. So the cons are, again, I think the biggest one is absolutely not a controlled environment. If I ask you to go and run a speed test on your laptop right now, you will pick your favorite speed test site. You'll probably access it from your laptop, which is connected over Wi-Fi, and you'll run it. Mm-hmm. If you then take your laptop and you go and connect it over Ethernet cable to your router, there's a good chance you're going to get quite a significantly different result. It's not a controlled environment. There's factors which the speed test website or app can't control and B, can't know about, so can't even account for after the fact. For example, what type of hardware, what type of machine are you running on? Is it a laptop, a desktop? Is it a phone? Because these all have different capabilities. What else is running on the machine at the same time? Mm-hmm. What browser are you running? Different browsers have different performance characteristics. Obviously, the big one is how is the machine connected? Is it over Ethernet or Wi-Fi? What generation Wi-Fi? How noisy is it? What's your signal strength? All of these factors have a huge impact on the measurement you run right now. Then, of course, beyond this, there's the sampling aspects or the sampling cons that come with crowdsourced measurements. So if it's all on-demand user measurements, so a user presses a button to run a test, then what happens at 4 o'clock in the morning when your computer switched off and you're in bed? You don't get any tests at that point. So, it's not really a repeatable data set for a number of reasons. Okay, I'm going to wrap this up. I'm sorry. and then item 2B is basically scheduled probe-based measurements, which is where we started. And it's still pretty similar to what we do today. We didn't want to go anywhere near passive measurements. We thought crowdsourced measurements had a number of limitations. So what we wanted to do was have something which was much more robust and more predictable. You have something deployed inside the user's home, which is homogeneous. So it's the same thing everywhere. It's connected in the same way. It's powered on all the time. And it's running tests according to a predefined test schedule. So what that means is you aren't having to deal with different devices, different capabilities. You don't have to worry about the software that's running on the device because it's the same everywhere. The device is connected in the same way. via Ethernet cable, which doesn't have any of the limitations of Wi-Fi networks, particularly back at the time, which was very, very early days in 2008, relatively mm-hmm. speaking. And we're also able to deal with other factors there as well. And the last thing I mentioned there is because it's powered on all the time, we can run scheduled measurements, which is measurements ran 20 or could run 24/7. So we could run tests, active tests, even at 4 o'clock in the morning when you're fast asleep. Mm-hmm. And then the last perk of being on a device which is at the edge of the user's network inside the home is that you can see whether other devices inside the home are trying to use the internet at the same time. And if so, then don't run the tests. And we call this cross-traffic detection because we don't want our measurements to be influenced by other traffic from the outside. And equally, we don't want to disrupt other users' enjoyment of the internet. So all of this led to the conclusion that the most scientifically robust way for us to have a good measurement methodology was to have scheduled tests running on a hardware device connected via Ethernet inside the user's home, running tests 24/7 and taking into account cross-traffic. So that led us to build the first white box. I think in the interest of fairness, I should definitely acknowledge the cons, but the big cons are deployment. It's a hassle now, right? We have to send out a hardware device to users' homes. The user has to receive it from the postman, plug it in. It's self-installed, so it's not painful, but for non-technical users, it certainly raises some eyebrows. So they have mm-hmm. to plug it in, and that's it adds time. It's not an instant deployment. It can take, we have to post something to someone. When you're doing this kind of stuff, you can't scale to millions and millions of devices. You're probably going to be talking in thousands or tens of thousands at most.
So Sam, it's not only the means you test, but the actual way you test applications differs as well. Can you explain a bit about that?
Yes, good point, actually. From when we started until about 2015-ish, our focus was very much on quality of service measurement. So this would be things like basically what you would imagine when you think about broadband tests. So download speed, upload speed, latency, packet loss, and you'd throw in some jitter measurements and DNS tests and a few other things as well. But it was still, the idea was still very much testing the quality of the ISP's connection and controlling both ends of the tests. So testing from a hardware device or a browser to a dedicated test server at the other end. Mm-hmm. And that's great. And that's basically what most other broadband measurement or internet measurement companies do as well. But of course, I can't imagine any of us are buying our broadband connections purely just to run speed tests. We generally buy our broadband connections in order to stream stuff on Netflix or buy stuff on Amazon or do podcasts with you, Barry. So there's lots of different things that we might use our internet connections for, right? Just running speed tests alone is not really representative of anything other than running a speed test. Don't get me wrong, you need the speed testing and the quality of server tests are important because they kind of set a baseline. Your performance to real applications might be quite significantly different. And it might not be your ISP's fault. It might be the decision of Netflix and where they choose to host their infrastructure or Fortnite and where they how they configure their servers and where they're located and so on. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, the user cares about it. So regardless of whose fault it is, the user definitely cares about how these applications are performing. And because the user cares about it, obviously they're going to, they're going to call the ISP if it's not satisfactory. That means it's now the ISP's problem. They have to care about it. And B, our other type of customer, the regulators, they certainly care about how applications are performing. Back in 2015, we started looking at measuring specific applications. And this isn't taking our existing tests, like our speed tests, and then applying some sort of mathematical model to them and saying, because we can stream at 2 megabits per second, then we can watch a YouTube SD video and doing all that hand-wavy stuff. We're not doing that. We're actually streaming real content. And the crucial thing is we're exchanging real application traffic with the real application servers in order to carry out these measurements. So for example, with YouTube, we're actually streaming real real YouTube videos from the real YouTube servers, which might be deployed inside your ISP's network. In fact, that's very common, in order to infer YouTube performance. And as far as I know, not really any other internet measurement company has such a focus on application testing like we do. They tend to focus more on the QoS metrics, and some others will use the model-based approach to infer application performance based on the QoS test results, rather than doing real application testing to the real application servers. So yeah, I think we're relatively unique in that. I'm sure others will be we'll catch up. But yeah, I think that's quite an important part of our arsenal as well.
You mentioned earlier that you started out by supplying white boxes to testers, but you've since moved to putting software agents inside the broadband routers themselves. What difference has that made to the speed test data you can gather?
Okay, so there's a few different parts there. If you recall, when I was talking about the scheduled probe-based tests, and you know, i.e. the white boxes earlier on, I mentioned some of the limitations of that around the scale and the time to deploy it and so on. Deploying our software agents inside the routers, I won't say it's a silver bullet, but it's really, really close to a silver bullet because it overcomes all of those limitations that we have with the byte box. So purely from a, I'll talk about the measurement methodology in a minute, but from a logistical point of view, it's great for us, and it's great for the ISP customer because they can deploy a software update to their routers. So no device is posted out anymore. The user doesn't have to do anything. They don't have to plug any device in. It's just an over-the-air software update. They can deploy this to millions of devices overnight, and it has all of the same measurement methodology and functionality as the white box. And yeah, I guess so really it solves the logistical problems with deployment, it solves the scale problems, and it solves the time to deploy. So it's been a really big win for us with the ISPs. I will add, of course, there are downsides to this as well, right? Because you need to write software in such a way that it can be deployed inside all of these routers. And if you think to the mobile phone market, people often say that Android is quite a fragmented ecosystem on the mobile side. Just wait until you see the router environment. That makes Android look like a super tidy place. So building software for routers can be very, very painful. And the first times we did it back in 2017-ish, or sorry, 2015 or 16, it was quite a painful process. But nowadays, we've got a really good team, and we're able to turn these out really quickly. In many cases, one of our generic ones will suffice. And we've worked with dozens of different CPE manufacturers now. So yeah, it's really, really picking up steam.
You touched on it there, Sam, but the hardware inside routers is relatively limited. How do you ensure your measurements are accurate?
Yeah, good question. I guess it's worth touching a little bit on some of the internals of routers at this point. Routers have a processor in them, just like your computer or your phone does right now. Mm-hmm. So there'll be the processor, there'll be a network switch, there will be typically a Linux-based operating system running inside it, and there'll be a Wi-Fi interface or Wi-Fi radio or two handling 2.4 gigahertz and 5 gigahertz Wi-Fi and so on. Now, normally what happens when, so if you forget about measurements for a second, just forget we exist. Normally when you are a user and you're using, you're connected to your Wi-Fi router and you're, let's say, downloading something from the internet, or you're accessing the internet through your Wi-Fi router, the main processor inside the router does not see your traffic. That means your processor is not the processor inside your router is not handling the routing of traffic. Mm-hmm. Normally there is a separate coprocessor, something called usually called a fast path, which handles things like NATs, network address translation, and routing. So routing, firewalling, network address translation is usually handled by a coprocessor inside the router. And that's how, you know, relatively low cost routers can still route traffic at high speeds, like 1 gigabit per second, because they do it all in hardware. It's a little bit like network switches. They do all the switching in hardware rather than software. Mm-hmm. When people say, are you doing it in software or are you doing it in hardware? What they really mean is, when they say, are you doing it in software, they mean, are you running code on the main processor to handle this stuff? Or are you delegating responsibility to some external co-processor, which is doing all the heavy lifting? Our agent, our router agent, as we call it, runs on the main processor inside the router for a number of reasons. But yeah, it runs on the main processor inside the router. This is the same for everyone who does this kind of stuff. But of course, that means we can be limited by the power of this main processor. Oftentimes, this main processor is not actually powerful enough on a very, very high speed connections to actually route traffic at the connected line speed. So if you imagine, coming back to my example earlier, if you imagine your router at home didn't have this dedicated coprocessor for fast path routing of network traffic, and everything had to go through the main processor, you probably find you couldn't get more than 400 or 500 megabits per second on lots of fairly common routers. Mm-hmm. And obviously that's no good, because ISPs are selling 1 gig connections now, and faster sometimes. So on those kinds of routers, which thankfully aren't super common, these relatively low power, low processor power routers, what we do is we have pretty good relationships with the chipset vendors. So the people who actually manufacture these processors, and there's very few of these. Really, the big players in the industry are Broadcom and Qualcomm and MediaTek. Intel kind of used to do it, but they've kind of mostly pulled out now. And there's a few other smaller ones as well. But yeah, Broadcom, Qualcomm, MediaTek are the big ones by far. And what those companies have is a way for third parties to run software on their dedicated coprocessors. Effectively, we call this running hardware accelerated measurements. So we're making use of this dedicated separate hardware accelerators. So we can run our very network intensive measurements. And remember, lots of our measurements aren't super network intensive. So things like, you know, measuring Google Meet or Fortnite, for example, don't really require much bandwidth. So there's no need to use these coprocessors. But for speed tests, for example, on lines faster than 1 gigabit per second, often we do have to use these hardware accelerators or these coprocessors. And that requires basically quite a lot of, well, two things. One, it requires pretty good relationships with the chipset vendors for them to actually give you access to this stuff and to spend time with you and so on. And the other is, it requires quite a good development team, because these things are not easy to work with. But using these things, we can get we can do things like, you know, measure 10 gigabits per second on relatively low-end commodity hardware, get very, very reliable and accurate results.
And you're not only working with the broadband providers now, but with third-party router manufacturers. So explain what benefits that brings to the manufacturers and consumers.
Sure. So for context, historically, when we've been talking about deploying our router agent, mostly it's been in conjunction with operators or ISPs. And they'd be doing this for their own purposes, like for customer support or for network engineering and looking at the macro performance level across the entire network. But as you say, more recently, I'd say over the past year or so, we've been doing a lot more work with the retail router manufacturers. Imagine you pop down to PC World or Best Buy and you go to buy a router off the shelf. Those router manufacturers are very different people to the ones who build custom routers for the likes of, you know, BT and Sky and Virgin and Comcast and Charter and so on. So they're very different companies with very different business models. Mm-hmm. What benefits does this bring to the manufacturers and consumers? So from the manufacturers' side of things, they get basically all of the benefits of the engineering that we've put into our measurements over the past 15 years or so. So it's not just speed testing. We also have all of the quality of experience measurements. We do the cross traffic checks. It's good for the regulatory measurements as well. So meeting Ofcom style requirements or the Connect America Fund or RDOF requirements in the US. All of our benefits are basically instantly available to the to the manufacturers. Mm-hmm. And they get the benefit of our relationships with the chipset vendors as well. So we can make use of the hardware accelerated measurements in order to measure the very, very highest speeds. And then ultimately, these retail router manufacturers, they typically have some web interface on the routers, or they have a companion mobile app, and our measurements are used to power what that app shows to the consumer. So the consumer ultimately benefits from these measurements as well. Now, at the moment, we're really kind of just scratching the surface there. Lots of the retail equipment manufacturers haven't yet, I'd say, widely exposed all of the measurements we're running to consumers, but that's definitely something which is, the trend is in that direction. They're still, historically, they've been quite focused on speed, of course, as well. So their main motivation has been on things like hardware accelerated tests and so on. But there's definitely an interest from every, well, as we talked about in previous podcasts, there's definitely an interest in the industry on looking at beyond speed and more cross actual real application performance. And that's one we're very well placed to help with.
And finally, Sam, how is all that data you collect from the white boxes and the software agents stored?
Well, we delegate that problem to our friends at Google, where we use Google Cloud Platform. They're much better at running infrastructure and handling very large volumes of data than we are. So yeah, we do what everyone else does. We make use of one of the hyperscalers these days. So in particular, we use there's lots of stuff in the platform, but Kafka for event streaming. So as measurement data comes in, it's sent to Kafka topics, and we process it asynchronously. And ultimately, all of the measurement data is stored in Google BigQuery, which is a huge column-based database, which is really good for analyzing very large volumes of data. Embarrassingly, I don't know the current volume of collection per day. It's well into the billions of measurements per day, though, and tens of billions per month. So, we'd struggle to do that on something other than Google's platform. Especially, we might be able to do it right now, building our own infrastructure. But the way the trend and the growth is heading, particularly from embedding our software inside routers, it could be 10 times as large in a year's time or 2 years time. Mm-hmm. So we just don't want the hassle. It's not really our bread and butter. Our bread and butter is the measurements and doing what we do well with everything around the measurements and the plumbing around it. It's not really running very large infrastructure, which hyperscalers are very well placed to do.
That's it for this episode of the Sam Knows podcast. If you want to read the article that accompanies this podcast, be sure to visit samknows.com/spotlight. Until next time, goodbye.